Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints. And good morning, Marcia. She's listening. I know she's listening. I could see her there. And the snow is still out there. The ice is there. It's freezing, but the sun's shining, so maybe it'll melt. But this is going to be a really great show because the topic of this particular book is frightening. And it's something that could actually, I think, can happen to someone. So when Laura Sousa, daughter of a U.S. senator, vanishes from a college campus, celebrated FBI profiler Special Agent Atticus Spencer, who I think is a great character, and forensic psychiatrist Dr. Caitlin Cassidy, who else I liked, are called in. 13 years ago, Laura and her nanny disappeared from her family's Denver home. Laura was found alive, but her nanny was not so lucky, and the killer was never caught. Laura could identify him if she only didn't have a deep hole in her memory. And she's missing again. So is the kidnapper out there? And I'm not going to say any more because Carrie's here, and she's the author of Stolen. Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning, Fran. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm doing very
I'm excited.
Well. I have to say, we're very lucky in Phoenix. I'm in sunny, warm Phoenix, and feeling for all of you in New York City. I hope everyone's safe in the city who's driving.
Yeah, they need to be really careful because the roads are not the best, and they actually closed the schools for one whole day. They should have closed it for two to make it easier for people to park and for the teachers to get in, but at least I got one. So when creating this novel, how did you come up with the major plot of the story? What did you decide to relive a kidnapping after 13 years?
I'm not sure exactly how the kidnapping issue evolved, but I will tell you that the way the story evolved is that I am a huge fan of real crime cases, not just true crime books, but I watch 48 Hours, I watch Dateline, I read blogs, and there are so many cases where the crime is not solved. There are a lot of mistakes that are made in crime scene collection, in the crime scene evidence collection. It's not like on CSI where they send out a team of experts that never make any mistakes and they do a really thorough job collecting all the evidence at a crime scene. It's usually, you know, a much more human process and prone to error. And in a case that's very sensational, sometimes the public will develop certain theories about who did it and what happened and why. And occasionally, innocent or not so innocent people will get caught up in the middle of this firestorm of public opinion about what happened and who did it. And so I just became very obsessed or interested in the idea of what would you do if you were at the center of this case and all this media attention was directed at you, and perhaps you were young at the time and you didn't really know what was going on. So I kind of amalgamated several real life cases in terms of mistakes that were made. And I really became interested in what would it be like to be at the center of this and to not know what really happened. And how would that affect you, as you developed over the course of your lifetime? How would that affect your personality? How would that affect your life? And as a writer, I was really initially wondering, and what if you were guilty? Or what if you were innocent? You know, how would all of those things interact? And so that's how I came up with the character of Laura Chaucer. And then the story of what actually happened, the kidnapping, et cetera, evolve from there. But that's where the initial grain of the story came from, was that idea of what would it be like to grow up in that kind of an environment.
That's scary. That is scary. So when you created the title Stolen, it sort of means a couple of things. There's like a multiple meaning there.
Yes.
They stole her identity, they stole her mind, and yet they stole her. And that was really very good because I said, really, there's a whole lot of meanings in this particular story. And they don't just always apply to Laura.
Yeah, it's very insightful that you picked up on that. Stolen, really, it isn't just that she was kidnapped from her home, but her innocence was stolen. But really, her entire life was stolen from her over the course of events due to this terrible thing that happened during her lifetime. So, you know, we really don't know who is to blame here and what's happening. And she herself is unsure. And because she's unsure, that allows us to go deep in her head and still not know the answer to the mystery because she doesn't know the answer.
It's scary.
So a lot was stolen from a lot of people.
It's scary what happened to her. So tell us about one. Why did so many people at first believe that she did not disappear but was taken? And how would someone in the field of mental health define her problem? I mean, almost at times when I was reading it, I said, they're trying to gaslight this poor thing and make her think she's crazy.
Right. It definitely was a case of gaslighting. I think there was intentional gaslighting in some situations. I don't want to spoil the story, but there were definitely people in her world who were gaslighting her. And then there were other intentionally, and there were other people in her world who were gaslighting her because they were just that kind of narcissistic person that, you know, they needed to control her, but I don't even believe that they were aware of what they were doing. In their mind, they had her best interest at heart.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of hard to separate who is doing something maliciously and who is doing something that is malicious, but not from a place of malicious intent. But this whole concept of gaslighting, I think it's really fascinating because I agree that this happens in real life. And it doesn't happen always at this level, but it happens in real life where someone has their own view of reality and it is so strong and they are so insistent that they can make you believe that it's raining outside when it's sunny. If you're vulnerable, if you have the right psyche, if you're under their control, if this person is an authority figure, it can really be easy to begin to question your own reality if this person who's challenging your view of reality is someone that you are very dependent on or that you look up to. It's very easy to distrust yourself and to begin to trust this other person who is so insistent on what reality is. And we see that in a lot of forms in our world. It is very scary when that happens.
Yeah, it is scary, very, very scary, to be very honest. I mean, I know that, you know, that not only gaslighting in this specific way, but they can also have, you know, somebody comes home and they put a book down and they can't find it. And they say, well, where did I put it? You never had it. You order something for dinner and they say, well, I didn't tell you to order for dinner. I brought something in. And you begin to say, like, did I do that? And just little things like that. And this was scary. So what happened the first time that she was taken that had scared her emotionally and physically, and then they thought the solution, which of course it's not, was giving her more powerful drugs. The drugs are supposed to keep her from ever figuring out who she was or anything. So how did you come to do that? That was good.
Well, I think, again, I hate to say this, but it does happen in real life where...
Yeah, I know.
First of all, I want to mention that I am a former clinical psychologist, and I have a lot of respect for the professions, the mental health professions, for mental health social workers, for counselors, for psychologists, for psychiatrists. And I'm afraid that psychiatrists might be getting a little bit of a bad rap in this book. So I just want to put that disclaimer in there that this is fiction, a fictionalized hyperbole, and it's the abuse of psychiatry at its currently, drugs can be used to control people. You know, there's what we call psychological restraint or chemical restraint on a very common level where if someone's behavior is out of control, if you're on an inpatient hospital ward, for example, and the patient is combative, you can be given a sedative dose to control your behavior. And on a long-term level, it's not uncommon at all for people whose behavior is undesirable for them to be given multiple drugs to control their behavior. So there's always a fine line between what is in that person's best interest and what is in the authoritarian person or the person in authority, what is in their best interest? When are we treating the family's desires rather than the patient, or society's desires rather than the patient? So there's this whole issue of patient civil rights. And I don't think I was necessarily aiming for that when I wrote the book, but definitely, you know, I think that's a component of the story and something that I think can spark meaningful thought, like where do civil rights begin and end in cases like this?
Yeah, that's true. I know my mom had Alzheimer's, and she was home. And I went to maybe 20 or 30 nursing homes, and each one said the same thing. When the patient gets out of control, we put them to sleep with a whole bunch of drugs. And I said, that's not going to happen. And I said, that's not going to happen. And they said, well, why do you think that, you know, this is necessary, or can you control them? They would prefer at times, and that was scary, that they would drug the patients, even people with ADHD that were in group homes, I heard that,
yes.
Or autistic, the same thing. And I said, well, why would you want to give them drugs? Why can't you just try to work with them? Well, we don't want to get out there, they're violent, blah, blah, blah. My mother was not violent. She was just she lost her mind in a sense. And she was funny, though. She would say the funniest thing. So I immediately got soured. And then one nursing home called me every day, when are you putting your mother here? I said, when the sky turns purple.
Well, I think that they're very lucky to have you.
Yeah, I said there was no way. So why did her parents trust Grady Webber? Why did he put her in his hands? And I didn't like this guy at all.
Well, some of this is kind of getting into some of the twists in the story that I don't want to go into too much detail. But they had reasons to believe in Grady, and they also. I will say, especially her mother and her parents were very interested in her did not want her to be under a lot of distress. I think the way her father put it was, you know, he wanted to make sure she, you know, was able to sleep at night. And basically the family and the psychiatrist decided together that it was in her interest to really have total control of everything that was going on in her life. So she basically became a prisoner in her own home. There was so much security surrounding her because of the fear of, you know, is the kidnapper going to come back, that she really was not able to develop a normal life. And I think that that was a driving force for her in the book, that she wanted a normal life very badly. And at whatever cost, she really wanted that life. And the people surrounding her wanted her to be safe. She wanted to have a normal life. And those two things seem to be in conflict with each other. So we won't say, you know, it's too hard to get into who, you know, who in this situation had her real best interest at heart and who did not. But let's just say it was a mixed bag. Some people might not have had her best interest at heart.
No, not really. So tell us about Caitlin and Atticus and their backstories, and how come they were called in. I like these two characters. I hope you're going to bring them back.
Oh, yes, absolutely. They're coming back. Well, they were called in because they are kind of they're on a roll. They've had several back-to-back very prominent cases that have been very publicized in the media. And the case that they had just prior to Stolen, they were in the book Notorious. They were working on a case in Dallas that involved some very high-level government officials. And at the end of that story, they've been trying to get to Tahiti. They've been trying to take a vacation for a long time, and it never happens. And they said, there's nothing that's going to keep us from, you know, taking this vacation and going to Tahiti and, you know, really enjoying our relationship with each other. And this is at the end of the case in Dallas. The president of the United States is on the phone with them regarding the case in Dallas that they've just wrapped up. And he tells them that, you know, there's a United States senator that needs help. And he makes a personal plea for them to go and look into this situation in Colorado. So it's a little bit hard when you have, A, the President of the United States requesting your personal assistance with a case for someone, you know, that he knows personally. His, you know, he's a U.S. senator. He's worried about this person in the Senate that he knows and the daughter missing. And, B, when you know that a young woman is missing and, you know, she's in distress, it's hard to turn that down. So, of course, Katie and Spence immediately hop on the plane and head out to Denver to see what they can do for the case.
Well, they really did a good job. And, by the way, Cheryl's listening from Partners in Crime. She says hi.
Hi, Cheryl.
And she's listening. She just emailed me to tell me what a great interview. So that's good. And so why were the police brought into the case, and how did they react or respond to them? They weren't too thrilled to have them there. A lot of times they don't want to coordinate.
Well, I think that sometimes we bring up the conflict in fiction a little more than what it is in reality. But the truth is that in reality, there is a little bit of antagonism between the local police at various departments within the local police, between the state and then when the FBI becomes involved. But definitely this is a case where the FBI, it was appropriate for them to come in and become involved in a kidnap of a United States senator's daughter. And the police, the detective in charge of the case, is very determined that they're all going to get along. But there's a little bit of resentment there. The other, just because no one wants someone to come in and take over their case. The other issue in this particular situation was that there was the previous case had gone unsolved. And this is where, you know, we talked about earlier about there was a lot of media attention to the previous case. So the police department was really defensive about anyone coming in and looking at all the mistakes that were made in that case. And there were plenty of them. And the entire investigation was impacted by those mistakes. When you bring in the FBI, you're going to definitely be they're going to be defensive about, you know, are people going to be calling us the past for these previous errors that had been made. At the same time, there's a very high level of motivation to bring this young woman home safely and to find her because there was the previous case and they want to make sure that they get it right this time. So the stakes are very, very high in this situation.
Well, wait till they find out the truth about it. They're not going to believe it. But we're not going to, oh, wow. And I said, I feel I got it. And I go, oh, my God. So why did they face so many obstacles just trying to piece together the case and to find Laura? And my favorite part, I have to add the next question, was when you allowed the readers to let us in on her fears and her plight, and you could hear her words, and you hear her saying, I'm not going to let them down. I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to try and get away. Why was she more? She was confused. And at times she wasn't confused. So why did you decide to use a first person narrative to let us know what Laura was thinking, which really helped a lot for the, you know, to Renita to understand Laura's point of view?
Well, I think the deep point of view that I used with Laura was really important for me because Laura was the heart of the story. And Laura really was one of the things in my books that I like to have is a strong but damaged protagonist who's really facing down the forces of evil. And in real life, you know, all of us are strong and all of us are damaged on some level. And all of us have obstacles that we have to overcome. And in fiction, it becomes exaggerated. It becomes hyperbole. But we all face difficult issues and difficult choices. And we all at times don't feel capable of handling them. But in my stories, I like to see a protagonist really dig down, find his or her strength, and overcome impossible odds. And so for Laura, the story, Laura is the heart of the story. So we have to be deep, deep, deep in her head. And that's why I use such deep point of view with her. And also it's really fun because Cassidy and Spencer are ongoing characters, and in the beginning of the series, we really see, especially with Caitlin, we see how damaged she is and what she has to overcome. But as time goes on, readers, they've already had that story. They're going to still continue to get to know Katie and Spence more in depth. We're going to find out new things about them in every book. Their relationship is going to evolve in every book. But readers, I think, want something fresh. And I know as a writer, I want something fresh. And so bringing in that through that we can, who's not necessarily the quote-unquote creepy villain, but someone that readers can relate to, I think is important for keeping the story interesting and fresh.
Yeah, it was. Because, first of all, let me thank your publisher for creating the book that they copied for me in large print, which really made it easier.
Oh, great.
And, I didn't get the original copy. They actually put one together for me. And it made it easier to read because it was all put together. And the only thing I didn't want, which I just looked up, was a summary of the book because it didn't come on the back of the book.
Uh-huh.
But that's okay.
You know, friend,
and
I have to tell you something funny about that. I also need large print. And so on my computer, my own files are always at, say, 175%, something like that. But I think it's funny because then I'll send it out to people and they'll open it up and be like, oh my goodness, you know, like, why is this file so huge? So, but I'm very glad to hear that you got a large print version so that it was easy for you to read.
Not only was it easy for me to read, it was easy for me to hold. A lot of times when people don't have ARCs or manuscripts, they print out the book and then they send me paper. And then they forget to page it. And then I can't read
Yeah.
it. And then I send it back and I go like, you got to be kidding me. I can't read this. And, I mean, one was like a 500-page book and it wasn't paged. So I had to sit there and page it just so I wouldn't lose sight of what the book was about. And I probably should have lost sight to start with. But what were you trying to convey to the reader? When we meet Grady and we realize that he knows Caitlin and he intimidates her and she's not that easily intimidated, what was their past? Because I didn't like this character at all. I liked her, though.
Well, their past is that she is a psychiatrist. And as part of training as a psychiatrist, one will go through an internship and then a psychiatric residency at a teaching hospital. And the doctors who are in charge of the training program are called attending physicians, and they're supervising physicians, and they're in charge of educating the young doctors who are still, they're doctors already, but they're in the process of getting their training. So they're in it's like a teacher-student relationship. And she was at the teaching hospital where Grady was the chief of psychiatry. And he was responsible for the monitoring the entire residency program, the internship program. And he abused his power a little bit in that he got involved in a romantic relationship with Caitlin. Was very, very vulnerable at the time. I just want to point out that she was younger when she was involved with Grady. She had lost her father in a very tragic way. And she kind of fell under Grady's spell. And Grady, as unpleasant as readers will find him, has the ability to be very charming. He's really a sociopath. And so he can be very, very manipulative and very charming. And she fell under his spell when she was younger. But she kind of came out of that very quickly. And she realized very quickly, you know, I don't want to be involved with you. And when she tried to separate herself from him, then that's when he really began to show his true colors. He became almost to the point of stalking her in the halls of the hospital. And this is where a little bit of gaslighting would come in, even on a very low level. With Caitlin, there's gaslighting on many levels throughout the book. But she would say, you know, why are you following me? And he'd say, hey, I'm your supervisor. It's my job to follow you around the hospital and to know what's going on. And anytime she would confront him on his inappropriate behavior, he would find a way to make it sound like, no, that's really appropriate. And you're kind of crazy for thinking that I'm being inappropriate. And this is something that I think happens to women. This is something that women and men can relate to if they've been ever in an abusive relationship, either emotionally abusive or physically abusive. The abuser will often do something quite inappropriate and then make it sound as if, no, you deserved that, or you're misinterpreting, you're crazy for thinking that. And I think to some, on some level, a lot of people can relate to this. But fortunately, Caitlin is a very, very strong character at this point in her life, and she certainly is not going to let Grady her at this point in her life. So in this story, you know, he doesn't really get to manipulate her. And I like that she's able to come back later in life and kind of give him what he deserves.
Yeah, she did, and I was really glad because I wanted to give him a couple of what he deserves. I'm like, can't you see what he's doing? He was doing his own brand of gaslighting and trying to make her think that, you know, it's okay to be like this. It's your fault that you did this. It's not my fault. You know, when somebody does something wrong and they want to justify it in their own mind that they're not the ones that are guilty, so they make you feel like you're the guilty party. That's scary. And it's really scary. So tell us about Tracy and Whit, Laura's parents, and their relationship. They're kind of strange too.
Right. Well, a relationship where there are some inequities in power between Whit and really anyone in his life, because he is a very powerful man. He's a rich man. He's a good-looking man. He's a charming man. He now has a lot of political power. And even back in the initial, I'm not going to say what the real-life case is, but there will be some people that I'm sure will recognize what the real-life case was. But in this story, which is totally fiction and not based on any one case, there is that situation where even when the police come out to his home in the beginning of the original case many years ago, the police are intimidated by him because he is such an imposing and important figure. And so that colors the relationship between Tracy and Whit as well. And it also colors the relationship between Grady and Whit. And you see him suck. He's this very powerful man himself, Grady Weber is, and you see him sucking up to Whit and kind of, you know, he's on the payroll for, you know, whatever Whit needs him for. You know, he wants to be around. He wants to make the most of this very advantageous relationship that he has with Whit Chaucer. And then Whit Chaucer is very, very involved with his daughter and is very insistent that he knows what's right for everybody in his family. So it's a complicated situation.
Well, when things get tense, we hear more from Laura. And when she finally tries and does escape, and I went, yay, hooray, finally, she's being held in this cabin. And what causes her to go back? And who is Cayman? And she was trying to avoid him, but he was paid to do something. So why did she decide after she got away to go back again? That was not smart.
Oh, go back to the cabin?
Yeah, she went back afterwards, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that is something that I think was important in that she had no place to go. And one of the issues in the very beginning of the story, when she's in the cabin and she's thinking about escaping and getting back home and getting to her family and getting to safety, getting back home to Denver, and she has this moment where she's out in the wilderness. And this story does take place in the Rocky Mountains, and a lot of it takes place in the Gore Mountain Range itself, you know, up in the wilderness area, in the Eagle's Nest Wilderness. And she realizes that there's no one watching out for her. There's no one giving her medications. There's no one protecting her. But at the same time, she somehow feels safer in this wilderness environment. And it's very confusing for her because home is where safety is supposed to be. But home is always where bad things have happened to her. So even in the beginning, there's a part of her that doesn't, she's conflicted. Part of her wants to go home and be with her family and be safe. And there's a part of her that just wants that freedom and wants to be on her own. And then when things heat up and she realizes that she's being pursued, her face is all over the media. You know, have you seen Laura Trosser? Where is she? There's literally a reward out on her head. And she doesn't have any place to go where she won't be recognized. And so she goes back. And she realizes this is, she believes that this is the last place anyone would expect her to go. So she believes that in this instance, the cabin is the safest place for her. And of course, she might not be right about that. But she it's born of her not knowing where else to go, having nowhere else to go, and then having that belief that, you know, this is the last place anyone would think to find her.
Well, who is Ranger Pandey, and what is his role in helping to find Laura? And when Laura processes the events, why does she debate with herself about Cayman and whether he's the crazy man that took her, but we know who the crazy man person was?
Laura is conducting her own investigation.
Yeah,
Ranger
that
Pandey
was cool.
Is a character, Ranger Pandey is a character whom we need somebody involved who knows the Eagles Wilderness area. And I have to say, Eagles Nest Wilderness, sorry. I have to say that part of the fun of writing this book was writing about Colorado, writing about the Gore Mountains, writing about the Eagles Nest Wilderness, which is a place where I've hiked many, many times with my children. And I like the idea of bringing the forest ranger into the story. Because there are a branch of the government and of the law enforcement, but it's not a branch that we see that often in crime fiction. There certainly are cases or authors who really highlight their role, but I really wanted to bring out the Forest Service role, and so that's why where Ranger Pandey came in. As far as why Laura was confused about whether Cayman was a danger to her or not. The reader, I hope, is also confused about that because Cayman is doing a lot of things that are questionable. And when the case starts to heat up, first of all, he's been following her around. He's the last person who ever, you know, saw her before she disappeared. So he's a little bit of a person of interest. He is a person of interest to the police at some point. And then when they go to question him, he disappears. He goes off the radar. No one can find him. And no one knows why. So Laura has a lot of reason to be mistrustful of Cayman. Also, she's beginning to realize that there is danger somewhere in her inner circle. And he's a big part of that inner circle. So that's why she has mistrust of him.
That's scary. So when they question her parents, and each one has their own point of view about Laura, one thinks that she's completely off, and the other one thinks something different. So Grady, she doesn't want him. Caitlin doesn't want him in on the case, but yet he insists that he's the right person to help them with the case, and he oversteps his bounds, so why does they allow him in? And they ask him to present his files, and when they ask to present the files to the police and the profiles, why does he? And what does he hope to gain by that?
Well, Grady is very egotistical, and he wants to be involved in a very high-profile case. He has other reasons for wanting, personal reasons for wanting to see what's happening with the investigation and be a part of the investigation. Grady also believes that he is more or less untouchable. And when he does give them the files, there's a lot in those files that shows Grady at his worst in terms of the kind of care that he's given Laura. But in Grady's mind, he believes that he can explain everything. He does not believe that anyone is going to question his decisions about medications or his actions toward Laura. He has an answer for everything, and he has no fear of turning over his files, and he believes that this makes him a useful part of the investigation. And he's actually trying to get onto the team. He wants to become part of the task force, and he's a little resentful that his little student, you know, little Caitlin Cassidy, is a very important forensic psychiatrist, and now she's part of this task force, and the task force is not including him. When he believes, a major player in the case because he was Laura's psychiatrist, which, of course, makes him a person who is not appropriate to be on the task force, but he doesn't see it that way. So he really wants to insert himself into this investigation. And what all of his motives are things that we'll have to find out as readers.
Well, I'm not going to give it away because I think that everybody should get a copy. And like I've been saying for the past 2 weeks, tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day. And rather than just give them shamrocks and, you know, soda bread, just put a book in the middle of a basket of something. And it's a much better present
just
for me.
I love it.
I really think so. With a little shamrock, a little leprechaun, a little soda bread, some Irish tea, and a book, you know, a couple of great books stolen. So, if you were going to analyze Grady, what would you think about him? What would as a clinical psychiatrist, what would you say was his problem?
Well, he has a personality disorder. He has
tendencies,
he has sociopathic tendencies, and he also has a narcissistic personality disorder. So if I had to diagnose him, I would say that that's it. And it's common for people who are very successful in life can have personality disorders, and Grady has two. So he's, you know, the kind of person that can function at a very high level. But his preoccupation with his own role in life, and everything centers around him. So even in the case of a missing woman, or in the earlier situation where Laura has gone missing, everything centers around his relationship to the Chaucer family, his relationship to Laura, what is happening to him as a result of being involved with this case. So it's really all about him. You know, he wants prestige, he wants control, he wants recognition, he wants fame, and he wants power. And he wants to be liked by the Chaucer family. And this kind of goes into a situation where, you know, when you have people who are in very influential positions will often have entourages around them. And being part of that entourage, in the case of Grady Weber, is a big part of his identity. You know, he is the Chaucer family psychiatrist. That's a big part of his identity. That's who he is.
Well,
me,
Caitlin goes to a
bit.
Cafe, and she winds up drugged, and
yes.
That's not
yes.
good. Yeah, she does, and she thinks that Grady did it, but what is the reality of it? Somebody wanted to get her out of the way, didn't they?
Could have been Grady. It could have been Grady. So we really don't, and there's a lot going on in that situation. And so this is when we kind of get a change in attitude from the police, because one of the things that Caitlin and Spence have been trying to get across to the police all along is that this original case might not have been what it seemed. This original kidnap might not have been really a kidnapping at all. And there could be a whole other scenario going on. And the police have been very, very, very resistant to the idea that there could be someone out there who is pursuing, excuse me, women of a certain type.
There were other, were you okay?
Yes, thank you.
There are other victims too, but we'll get to that. So who is Lisa Blake, and where does she fit in? And tell us about Inger and why her death seemed odd, because Laura's not the only person that this guy got. He got a few more.
He did get a few more. And it's at this point when the event happens at the cafe that the police begin to recognize that maybe Caitlin and Spence are correct, that there's, you know, someone out there who's after more women. And then they begin to look very hard at Grady and what's happening. So Lisa Blake is somebody from the past. And then what's going to happen at this point in the book, excuse me, I'm just having some water here to try to get my throat under control. What happens at this point in the storyline is that Caitlin and Spence have to go way back into the past, into Grady's past, into Whit Chaucer's past. They go back to the time when the two of them were friends and in the same fraternity at college. And that's where Lisa Blake comes into the story, because Lisa Blake is someone who in the past has accused Grady Weber of rape. And then she dropped the charges. So she's someone that they really want to talk to. And she becomes a pretty important part of the story late in the game. And she's somebody that has not been looked at earlier on in the police investigation, because the police have been going down a different path. But
well,
we all know
I forget.
That we should always listen to Katie and Spence, and that they're going to be on the right track. That's not really a spoiler. You know, I think readers know Katie and Spence are usually going to be on the right track.
Okay, so before I forget, because I don't want to forget, next Tuesday on the 21st at 10, I'm going to be interviewing Anthony France, The Outsider. That's a fantastic book. On the 23rd, My Kill Play by Tim Patton. Tim Patton is wrote this book to tell people what happened in roller derby. He's a former roller derby star from the San Francisco Bay Area Bombers. Yeah, I watched him. He's fantastic. And he wrote three books, My Razzle Dazzle, Roller Babes, and this one is called My Kill Play, and it talks about, true story, about what happens when AIDS hits the roller derby stars, including himself. A Tune for the Ivory Cloud by Jeffrey Wells is the 30th, and on April 3rd, Bella Gonza Belladonna by Terry Winetsky. It's about Navajo Indian tribe and the school and kind of type of education. It was interesting, plus murder. So without murder, you know, what would it be? It would be great. And we've got on April 5th, The Fixer, The Killing Kind by Jill Amy Rosenblatt. And on April 6th, I'm excited, New York Times bestselling author Charles Salzberg will be here with Swan's Way Out. And that's just some of what's coming up. And there's a whole lot more. So I'm going to ask a few more questions. Of course, let's see. Both Caitlin and Spencer had problems with their moms when they were younger. And you sort of created a situation then that was interesting with them. How did you decide to do that, to sort of bring the moms together? That was really cool.
Well, I'm glad you liked that. I actually really enjoyed having the moms be involved. And
yeah.
Caitlin and Spence are in a little bit of similar situations in that both of them have lost their father tragically. Spence's story is very complicated, and we don't find out until Notorious how complicated Spence's family life really is. We find out in the very first Cassie and Spencer series book, Judgment, what happened to Caitlin's father. He was executed for a crime he didn't commit. And this really put her in conflict with her mother, because she was interested in exonerating her father, and her mother just wanted to put it behind her.
I'm going to ask a few more questions, because you not too many more. So Grady, Laura decides to call Grady. And why does he insist that she is crazy and needs his help? And why does the killer, well, let's talk about the other victims, too. So why in heaven blazes would she call him, and he tells her that she needs to find him because she's crazy? But we know she's not crazy. Or maybe she is crazy. Why her?
Well,
why him?
The reason that she calls him is that she wants her parents to be reassured. And at this point in the story, there's been a press conference. And during the press conference, Grady has put himself out as the family spokesperson. And her parents are very, very distressed. And she knows that anything her father wants from her, she just kind of caves in. She doesn't want to call her father directly. So she calls Grady in order to get a message to her parents that she's alive and that she's safe. Because at this point, they don't know that she is. And there's a reward out for anyone who has seen her. And her parents are on television. They're begging for her safe return. And she has to get the word back to them. So she calls Grady and she says, look, this is what happened to me. You know, let my parents know. He is the family spokesperson. And he's also been her psychiatrist since she was 8 years old. So he's someone that, even though she feels resentment towards him, he's someone that the family has always trusted. And he's always been someone that she has trusted, although there's been a part of her that's, you know, chafed against him. So he is the logical person to call because he is the family spokesperson. So she calls him with the intent of getting information to her parents. Now, the reason she doesn't come back and go directly back to her parents is because she has an idea that there's a monster out there, and she feels a personal obligation to stop this monster. So that's why she can't go back. She can't go back until she knows what the truth is. The other thing is she doesn't believe people will believe her. She doesn't want to go back. She doesn't know what will happen to her. She doesn't know if she's going to be thrown in jail, or more likely, and what her biggest fear is that she's going to be locked up in this medicated cocoon, hospitalized once again. She just can't go back to that.
Well, we have a couple of other victims. So we've got Harriet and other victims,
yes.
And they have a relationship with Laura, and they all have something in common. And we also, I don't want to forget, so my next page of questions, there were other women that were kidnapped, and the first one was her aunt Angelina, and they thought Angelina was the
right
one that killed her. So nobody wanted to believe that. So who are the other victims, and what is the common denominator that this person is choosing, these particular people?
Well, this is the theory that Caitlin and Spence are putting forth, is that the original kidnapping was not about kidnapping Laura. The police have the idea that the nanny, Angelina, was in on the kidnap scheme, that's the most likely scenario. And their second choice scenario is that the nanny was collateral damage, that she just Laura was the intended victim, and then there was the ransom, and thank goodness Laura, you know, got home safely. But Angelina was killed. And so what Caitlin and Spence begin to look at is, well, what if Angelina, who's the person who was actually killed in this original crime, what if she was the intended victim all along? Now suddenly what we have is a case where, instead of focusing on the kidnap and ransom of an 8-year-old child, we have to look at who would be motivated to kill a young woman, a beautiful young woman with long dark hair and beautiful blue eyes. Mm-hmm. Who would be motivated to kill her and why? What would be going on? And then when Harriet turns up dead, Harriet is also a young woman of about the same age of Angelina. It occurs around the anniversary of the original kidnap, and she's really of the same type. And so, you know, Katie and Spence are wondering if somebody is actually targeting beautiful young women rather than, and that this kidnapping was all a distraction to get the police off of the right track. And they don't want the kidnapper does not want the police to know what the crime is really all about. Is this really a sexually motivated homicide? And are there more sexually motivated homicides out there? And so that becomes a big question. And, you know, perhaps the answer is yes, because we know that Caitlin and Spence are usually on the right track. So somewhere out there, there may be sexually motivated homicides out there. And then the other issue is that Laura, now that she is an adult, she is of the same age as these other young women, and she's of the same physical type. And there's a reason for that. It's not all coincidence, but that's something the reader will have to discover.
Well, they decide to reopen the case against Angelina, and then Caitlin becomes a target also. But what will happen if they find Laura, and who is Dr. Duncan? She's going to need some help anyway, even when they do find her, even when they ever find her.
Well, Dr. Duncan, and I wish I would have given Dr. Duncan maybe a little more time in the story, because like I said in the beginning of the interview, I really hate that, you know, I don't want the reader to come away with a very, very negative view of psychology or psychiatry. And Dr. Duncan is the good psychiatrist. He is the person who, and also Caitlin is the good psychiatrist. Both of them are looking at the way everything's been handled and saying, this is not an appropriate or therapeutic way to handle someone, no matter what the situation is, no matter what her mental condition. This is an inappropriate way to manage someone or to help them. It's not helpful to put someone in basically a sedated state where they're walking through life in a near comatose state, and constantly keeping them under the looking glass. So Caitlin and Dr. Duncan are both the good side of psychiatry, and they're trying to say, let's do what's necessary, let's do what's therapeutic, but let's allow Laura to develop and to use her mind, and let's listen to what she's saying and not discount everything as psychotic ramblings or hallucinations. That's another thing. A lot of what Laura sees, she's later told, oh, that was really a hallucination. So, of course, we don't know whether she's had hallucinations or whether these things are real. But Dr. Duncan, when she gets a hold of Laura after the family moves to Washington, D.C., she really looks into it on a much more objective level. She's not under the spell of the Chaucer family. She's not part of the entourage. She has no investment in seeing things the old way. And so Dr. Duncan really helps Laura find the courage to move away from her family, to start college. And, of course, once Laura gets to college and gets away from environment, something happens to her. So it's very confusing to her because she wants to be free, and she's been encouraged to go out on her own by Dr. Duncan, and her parents are saying, no, it's not safe. And then, of course, as soon as she gets away from them, something terrible does happen.
That's the scary part. So before we close, if Laura could speak to our listeners, and there are people on Facebook saying they're listening, by the way, and some of them are old friends that I grew up with, because they've really realized, and guess what, Just Girls got a radio show, and everybody's listening now. So if Laura could speak to our listeners, what would she say about her mental abilities, and what fear does she have, and how does someone overcome what she's been through?
I think Laura would say, trust your own senses. Mm. Don't let someone convince you not to trust yourself. And another really important thing that Laura discovers is that she discovers her own heart. She knows what's in her heart. She knows that in her heart there is no hate. There's no evil. There's no murder. And so she learns to trust in her own heart. So in some situations, she's looking at circumstances that are confusing, but what's not confusing to her is her own heart and who she is. So Laura says, trust yourself, know your heart.
That is true. So what is next for Caitlin and Spencer? The ending was priceless. I'm not going to give it away. How did you come up with that ending? And with the mom, oh, my God, I was like, I had tears in my eyes. I go, this was so priceless. How did you come up with that ending? And are they ever going to get married, these two?
Well, What I will say about the ending is I felt that what happened at the end of the book needed to be big, because readers have been,
yeah.
I don't want to say strung along, but they've been following this relationship book after book after book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes them a long time to even kiss. And I don't think they make love until Notorious, which is like, you know, I don't know which book it is, book four. So readers have been waiting a long time for things to happen with this couple. So I felt like this milestone needed to be big. So that's how I came up with that. I was like, okay, what would be really big? I came up with something that hope fits the bill.
That was a perfect ending. It couldn't have been any more perfect. I just absolutely loved it. So before we end, I do panel shows, by the way, with other authors in the same field. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you use a lot of real cases in your work, and so does Dr. Mark Rubenstein, who's a clinical forensic psychiatrist that worked with the Boston Bomber, Boston Marathon Bomber. And he wrote a book called Bedlam's Door about different cases in the hospital that were true that he worked with. And I'm wondering, if I put together something like that, would you be interested in joining the panel? And how do you use real cases in your work in your writing?
Yes, I would love to participate. That sounds wonderful. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Oh, this has been fun, and he's interesting, very interesting. And
I'd like to check his book out. What was the name of it again? Bedlam.
Bedlam's Door. And he dealt with Alzheimer's and stuff like that. And this is cute. My cousin just sent me an email, because I send it to everybody. Today is National Care About You Day.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It's so cute. And you just send this little picture of purple flowers to people that you care about. And I don't normally do stuff like that, but I just think it's hilarious. It's funny. So where can everybody learn more about you? And when's the next book coming out? Because I got to find out what happens next.
Well, the next book will be coming out in November, I think close to Thanksgiving. And everybody can find me on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Carrie Baldwin author is my Facebook page. You can also send me a friend request. I'm happy to friend you. A lot of times the page posts don't get seen as much as the personal page. So feel free to send me a friend request on my Carrie Baldwin page as well. And you can sign up for my newsletter at my website, www.carriebaldwin.com. And I actually have a free romantic suspense novella that I'm happy to give anyone who signs up for my newsletter. So I'd love to hear from readers. I'd love for you to be join my newsletter and talk to me on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter at Carrie Baldwin. But if I'm being honest, I'm not on Twitter nearly as much as Facebook. So feel free to come and find me and to email me. I'd love to hear from you.
I'm on Facebook, but I'm on Twitter, but I'm on LinkedIn too. And I'm finding that every time I put a review out on LinkedIn, everybody reads it. So give it about 10 minutes and everybody's going to read yours too. I guarantee it.
Right.
They comment. I get comments all the time like, excuse me? If you don't say something nice about the review, I don't want to hear it. No, they usually don't say anything nasty. And what happens is that after I put somebody's review up, they ask me if I can review theirs. And actually, at this point, I have about 40 books inside staring at me, really staring at me.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I read 10 at a time, but for some reason, sometimes you get, you know, review block, you might say. And
yeah.
Some of the books are like, I'm like, oh, my God, help. But I'm going to do it. But thank you so much. This has been great, and I can't wait to read the next one because I have to find out what happens next. And as long as you're going to bring those two back, I'd be interested to see what happens next with Laura, too, if you decided to bring her back, too, because she's an interesting character.
Yes, it would be good to know how her life turns out after all of these events. Fran, it has been so lovely talking to you. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for having
me. Me too. And feel better. Everybody,
all right,
the sun is shining. It's freezing. Go to Phoenix, Arizona. It's 87 degrees. It's much warmer there. Have a nice day, everybody, and bye.